so glad to be with you. It is wonderful to know that you're scattered around the globe and that you're tapping into this opportunity to look at loss. I want to say, first of all, what my goals are in meeting you in this class. The first one is to meet you where you are. So if there's one thing that I feel like I've really learned about grief and dealing with loss, it's that all of us are in our own journey with it, whether it's a big grief, quote-unquote, or a small grief, that I hope to meet you where you are and to welcome you in either your grief or in that which is blocking you from being able to be with your grief. And I hope to share a frame and a perspective that can serve you in dealing with future losses, whatever your losses are now, that you have kind of a different way to orient to it that hopes to support you and be life-serving. It's an honor to hold you in this place where you have heartache big or small. So I first wanted to check. I want to use our opportunity to do a little bit of polling. How many of you have right now that the reason you're on this call is because you're dealing with something that feels like a big grief right now?
Right now we have 57%.
Great. And are there those of you who feel like you're on this call because you just want a more philosophical or an approach to dealing with grief, but there's not really anything current or active?
7%.
Okay. And I'm wondering if anybody who didn't press 5 during either one of those times wants to say what you're here for or what applies to you that you're on this call.
I was drawn to this because of the process of mourning, which I want to embrace more.
Wonderful. I'm so glad you're there and glad that you're that you have that willingness to turn toward it. Thank you. That brings me to want to say that my opinion about this is only my opinion, it could be completely off, is that in our cultural context that often we don't want to have much to do with mourning or grief. Many of us turn away from that and try to get through it as quickly as possible or pretend it didn't happen or isn't there. And because I think of, particularly I think of NBC as being about relating to needs all the time in either celebration or mourning, then that means that, you know, a good chunk of the time we're relating to our needs that aren't being met in this moment, that we're still longing for. And so I really think of this work as an opportunity to not just deal with things when there's a big loss, but when we have our everyday sadnesses, our everyday losses, even if it's about, I really hoped I was going to get a nap and I didn't get to. So I'm hoping that that serves all of you. And I want to say up front that it all counts, that whether you're here because you've just lost a significant person in your life or a physical ability, a home or a job, a beloved pet, or something that might to others seem smaller than that but is large to you, then it completely counts. So I really want to encourage each one of you, if you have things that you want to ask or share, or when I ask for someone who'd like to speak, to really consider that you get to take up that space. There's nothing that doesn't count here. Let me move into a way that I often think about how to relate to this work is, so there are things both on the outside and on the inside that block us from being with our mourning or our grief, that we've lost something, that we've lost something that matters to us. And so I want you to think for just a moment, what is it that has blocked you at various times? Or what is it that you see as a block to mourning or grief? And I would love to hear from a few people so that we can kind of build a collective view of what those blocks are.
Well, my parents were the biggest block. It wasn't okay to cry.
So not okay to cry. So they gave you messages or, we'll say benignly, feedback that it wasn't okay to cry. And so you learned that you weren't going to get any kind of support or approval if you were crying. Is that?
Yeah, it was. So my dad cried easily, and he was embarrassed by that. And he didn't want me to be embarrassed by My grandmother cried easily also. So it wasn't just that crying wasn't okay. There was another layer to it.
Any specific messages that were said in your house about crying? There might not have been, but...
No, I don't remember any. What I remember is that when I did cry, people would ask me what's wrong with me. As a result, I've picked up a belief that there's something wrong with me.
Darn, that's a sticky one, too. Okay, thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Hi. I've noticed that I'm very careful about who I share my loss with because of not trusting that I'll be met where I am. And I've seen it create shock in people, and then immediately they're struggling for the right, for what they want, some words to like reassure me or fix me, or just, you could see they're just scrambling, and I just am like, yeah, you know, just like I just pull away. And so I find that I'm sort of very apprehensive about sharing, you know, I've just been not trusting that I'll be held and met where I am, and have been careful about sharing it. We're trying to take care of myself and my just wanting to be with my grief, but I'm concerned because as I move out into the world again, into work, how to breathe through that and how to see, you know, just be with it, like, oh, do they just care and they're just, this is about them and I don't need to reassure them that I'm okay. I can just, how to navigate that again, that stickiness, that kind of spaghetti knot of my needs and theirs and in this care.
Right. So just when you're looking for somebody, just as you said, just to hold you and be with you, to kind of help you have a container to release this into, that kind of reassuring or fixing or, you know, pat, pat, pat on your head or your back,
yeah,
or whatever, just stops it up. And you've had enough experiences like that that it's difficult to begin and start by trusting someone.
Yeah, particularly when they ask a fairly direct question, and I don't want to lie, but I'm really concerned. I maybe not have the spaciousness to share.
Right. So even then, you've got the torn of, okay, this is real. It's real and alive in me, and I want to be able to share it. And I'm not sure whether they've got it in them or what their intention is about how to meet me here.
Yeah, or just even to be able just to accept them for where they are, just have the capacity and the juice to be able to do that. But yes, thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad you're here.
I've had the benefit of collecting my thoughts a little. So building on what my predecessor said, one of the things that I heard that resonated with me was a shared language of expressing what I'm looking for. So am I looking for somebody to just listen? Am I looking for help in solving the problem? Am I looking for comfort or a shoulder to cry on? And I just don't always find that I either have the language because of the emotion, or the other person doesn't know how to respond in a way that together we find what the person, in this case, he is looking for in that moment. So shared language of expressing the need is one. The second one for me was, and I'm building to the big one, is just the practical matter sometimes of getting through the day, the time and the space to slow down and allow myself to mourn or grieve, in my case, some fairly significant losses over the last 3 years. And then the last one is just the fear that it will consume me, that I won't get out on the other side. When will it end? And then also this almost self-doubt of, okay, have I grieved enough? Am I done? So both the fear that it will consume me that keeps me from entering into that feeling, and then once I get through it, kind of that nervousness of, am I done, or do I have to go back and do more? So those are
right.
The three for me.
Right. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm so glad that you named the fear of being consumed by it, because any time I've ever offered this subject or this course, that one comes up. And it's often even more significant for people than they realize. So I wondered how many of you ever had that as a block? You've ever had that sense of, if I start crying, I might not stop. I might fall into a hole, not come out. Sometimes it has a form of, I might lose my mind or any number of different things like that. So quite a few of you relate to that. And I think one of the practical things that can help around building a kind of a grief resilience is noticing when you have grief or mourning that you do come out. Noticing that you've touched big grief even and that you came back, you know, that you came back to life, that you didn't stay there forever. So having some kind of a feedback mechanism and noticing the celebrations essentially of when you grieve and then how you feel afterwards. So I want to suggest that to people as a practice, if that's a fear that has been there for you, to see if you can, you know, if you have a way to remember, oh, right, I noticed that I grieved or that I cried hard, that something triggered off that old feeling of sadness and loss, and then I felt differently afterwards. It hit me for a while, and then I, you know, went on and made dinner or hung out with people or noticed the sky or the sunset or something like that. I want to suggest that to those of you for whom that has been active. And I want to give a chance for people to, I don't know what makes the most sense, maybe dyads for 2 minutes each to get a chance to say out loud with a witness, with a single witness, what the blocks are for you, the ones on the inside or on the outside, that get in the way of feeling like you have access to grief when it's there. So each one of you will get a chance, and what I encourage you to do is to simply, if you're the listener, just listen. You don't have to do any active empathy. You're there just listening for what is important to this person and being honored by that. So I'm hoping that that serves some of you to be able to reflect yourself and perhaps even, you know, hearing from a few people about some of the issues for them gave you some more insight or a little hint about what gets in the way. But I want to make room if anyone wants to share something that wasn't shared already, another block you've become aware of.
Two things I was thinking of, Kristen. One is when long-term grief or grief that relates to long-term issues has turned into depression. And even despite my best efforts to very actively grieve and pay attention to grief and be with grief and feel grief and be open to grief, some of it is so long-term that it has taken on the form of depression. And it's hard to budge that. That would be a block. There are many factors related to that, but I just was curious if you had anything to say about that. And then I'll share my other one, and then I'll just listen. The other one is related to what another person said about the situation that I'm here with is very complicated and complex and long-term, and it's hard to understand. And, you know, sometimes I try, and then I don't feel either heard or understood or received all kinds of things that feel really painful. And because of that experience of having that happen over time, sometimes I just don't even bother. But I really yearn to share and yearn to be true and authentic and to be understood.
And because of that complexity then and that sense of, well, I don't know that someone else is really going to get what the whole picture is here. There's a kind of a, no, don't even start.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try. Like that, yeah. And I want to address what you said about depression because I do very much relate to that myself in my own experience and in working with people. I think of it as actually when grief is stuck, when there isn't grief, that's what when I notice that I'm in something that's way more like numbness, cottony, heavy, that depressed feeling, it's like nothing is moving at all. And that's just the way that I relate to it from inside of my own system. Kind of that felt sense of depression. And I love that you named that, you know, that happens more often for you when it's long-term. So that when the qualities of hopelessness or powerlessness are wrapped up in whatever it is that the loss is about. You know, is there a thinking like, this is never going to get any better, there's nothing I can do here? Those are the most common two phrases in my mind, and I wonder if there's any that kind of come to the surface as I say those things.
I completely relate to exactly what you said, that sense of hopelessness and powerlessness, and that it's never going to get any better, so I'd rather just give up.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's not my nature to give up, and my truth is really not to give up. My truth is to really want to be, like you said, having the grief moving rather than stuck.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know if this is true in general, but I have noticed it in my latest round of grief, that sometimes allowing myself to essentially have what looks like a tantrum, which, you know, most of us don't think is very attractive after the age of 3, but to really let myself have the whiny, pouty, like, let that be, that often I'm holding that back before I have this feeling of stuck, depressed, hopeless. So sometimes that's an interesting door to open, and one that's, like I said, because we don't see that as very attractive, or it doesn't fit our image of ourselves, then it's something that we don't give much room for. We'll play around with some things like that, but I'm really glad that you named those pieces. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to do a shout out for my favorite one, which is that I just am pain avoidant. And my perception is that going into grief is painful. I don't want to reopen those wounds. And so that's my inner block to mourning, just wanting to avoid pain.
Right. I don't want to rip this Band-Aid off of there. Why would I want to do that?
You got it. Just very simple one.
Very simple and effective. If we're going to avoid pain, and we think that that's pain, then that means that we should stay away from that and find something else to do, distract.
So I'm really here on some mission to get through that. Intellectually, I could say, oh, that's not pain. However, I'm still reading it in my body as pain.
That is a perfect opportunity for me to give one of my favorite frames around grief. And I think this has been influenced. I've done a lot of work with Joanna Macy. M-A-C-Y, any of you who haven't been exposed to the kind of work she does, you can look her up on the internet. It's not NVC, but it is a powerful body of work about facing into our pain on behalf of Earth and our siblings and brother and sister beings and all that kind of stuff. So instead of feeling despair about the state of the world, is to face into it. One of the first times that I was with Joanna, she did a process, and in the middle of it, she talked about we don't grieve anything that we didn't love or that we don't love. And that was so absolutely beautifully revolutionary inside of me that it has really helped me not perceive something as pain, but as basically being willing to visit my love, even though the thing that I accessed it through is gone, even though that... This sounds too cold to me, but even though that specific strategy is gone, even though that way that I've been so comfortable and loved, you know, that person or animal or house or whatever it is gone from me for now, that I felt love for that. If we don't grieve anything we don't love, then we've got the opportunity once in a while to visit with that love, even though it's on to us in some temporal plane. And that is an act of courage in my mind, because there is something, if the pain isn't current, it is at least a recurrence. That's kind of how I think of it. That the pain was in the loss initially, and that loss still exists. And so I turn toward that I love, and in that, I'm going to feel that kind of flavor of almost bittersweet love lost. And that can be true even for something small, but it's certainly true for larger losses. So I want to give people an opportunity for a moment. If you are relating to a grief about a particular thing right now, And it certainly could be something that you lost a long time ago. But see what it's like to allow something to kind of come to the front. You don't know exactly what it is. Come to the front if you kind of cast about and say, what is it that I'd like to notice? What loss would I like to be with right now? Just see what it's like. This is almost such a quality of kind of a guided visualization or meditation. What it is that comes to you. Something that you've lost. Someone, some place, some ability. Some need even. And just give yourself the chance right now to notice, what is it that you have loved about that? What did that feeling of loving something about that feel like in you? See what it's like to look for specifically, what did you love about that? If it's a person, it might be the twinkle in their eye or the sound of their laughter or a thousand other things. If it's a place, it might be the way the light looked in the sky. So see if you can go for specifically as possible, because I really do believe that our love comes alive in the particular and the specific. And therein lies our access. So you're noticing what you loved, how it felt to love that. What specifically you missed. And take a few breaths. Notice what the felt sense is in your body. And I think I'll have you go back into your dyad. And you will have the opportunity, one person speaking, one person listening, to just describe that specific, that love, that felt sense, and what you missed. Thank you. So I want to get a chance to hear from a few people. First, I would love to hear one specific thing that a few people love. If you're willing to share a specific about that which you loved and lost. I will share one of mine. We had a kitten that I fell head over heels in love with. We fostered kittens for many, many rounds, and there was one cat that I don't know what about him, but I was bonkers for him. And when I think of Elliot, I love the way he would lay on his back with his front paws stretched above his head and his back paws stretched down toward his tail, and he would just spread out as wide as possible. And that cat wouldn't even move if he stepped next to his body. It was like he was, for me, my interpretation was the sonification, no, the catification of trust. He didn't move if he was relaxed. And so in that specific, I can remember him, and I can remember that feeling of loving him. I can find him and find my love of him in that specific. I wonder if my sharing that allowed anyone else to want to say what theirs was.
I will share, I lost my sister a year ago to breast cancer, and I was telling my partner that it was a challenging relationship. There were some long-standing difficulties that we never had a chance to completely work out. But the one thing that I'm really in touch with right now as I'm thinking about her is how she really, as my older sister, we were two girls out of a family of six. The four other siblings were boys, so we had this relationship as two sisters in the middle of all these young men. And she was my trailblazer, kind of the older sister who was going ahead of me, and we had similar track in life in terms of external things that we did. So school and college and graduate school. And so at every point, I felt like I could always ask my sister, or she would sort of tell me, you know, what is it like to be in college? And or I would visit her and I would get some information back. And I felt like she was always really loving and caring in the information that she would give me. She was very reassuring. So it was one way that I felt like she really shared her love with me, was by her letting me know how things were. So I'm really missing that.
She was willing to step out there ahead of you and kind of be your interpreter, your guide, your trailblazer to say, this is what you might expect. This is what I ran into.
Right.
Thank you. I feel the love in that, you know, in just that. Even though there's other complexity and other difficulty and all that other stuff, that be able to find a place that has that kind of, I want to say, purity of appreciation for that.
First, the thing that I experienced to get to that point of understanding what I loved about what I've lost, and mine is around a health situation, and was actually having to go through some sadness to get there. And quite honestly, I'm still in that place. Had a rough day dealing with it because I was in another setting that I actually walked out on because it did not feel safe. And this feels safer, but I literally want to run and hang up and just not deal with this. So I'm trying to stay with both the sadness to get to the other side to say, what am I missing about that? And so 18 months ago, I was diagnosed as HIV positive, and I'm very healthy now under medication, but what I loved about not being HIV positive is the freedom to not worry about either who I was choosing to be with sexually or having to take medicines every day and not forgetting my medicines when I travel or worried about running out of those medicines. There was a hope of intimacy with another human being that I have found at times in the last 18 months, but there's some fear there. But so I love that hope of intimacy and that intimacy with another human being and some joy and some wholeness that, you know, I felt whole back then, for whatever that term means. Normal is a word I tried to avoid. And then I couldn't find a positive to this, but just a lack of fear and shame. You know,
yeah.
This meeting that I was in earlier was about the spiritual and faith and religious community and how it responds to the HIV/AIDS community. And there was just so much of the story that I've heard for so many years about how the church has been judgmental and hateful and spiteful. And it was very hard for me to hear that because I know that fear and that shame. I've lived that for so long. I literally walked out of the meeting. I guess the lack of fear is, someone maybe can give me a word, or the lack of shame is, that's what I loved about not being HIV positive.
Right. What you said to begin with was that freedom, that there was like an unrestricted quality to your meeting of either intimate partners or of being able to travel without this kind of like, oh my God, I have to keep track of this thing. So that kind of fear, worry, energy, and the way that it ties up that which was free before, was free-flowing before. Does that fit?
Yes, that does. Yes.
And I think all of us can relate to what that energy of freedom is like. Freedom on the inside from having our energies gobbled up in worry and anxiety, or freedom on the outside. You know, both of those, you know, from a beauty of need, freedom is something that human beings love deeply and yearn for all the time. Or we forget that it's even possible, and then that's back to the morning. So thank you for naming that and for sharing that you're in this tender, vulnerable place coming out of this other meeting. And really seeking to find a place where your experience is valued and where people can meet you in caring instead of in judgment. So I just want to say that before I circle back around to kind of the blocks and the next piece, that I've been told by a number of people that have shared this kind of idea that often you can find, if you know that your grief is about something that you've loved, if you enter through that doorway, what is it that I love here? And what is it specifically that I've loved? A number of people that I've worked with have had access to a kind of a grief and a mourning and a non-stuck quality to relating to what they've lost in a way that they have access to again and again by going through that doorway. So I hope that becomes true for any of you that want to use that. It seems like it's been especially helpful when, as I said, when people say, since I lost my dad, but I haven't cried at all, that was 2 years ago, there's nothing there. That often if they look at what did they specifically love about him, even if there was a lot that they didn't, that they have access to grief in a different way. And of course that's not the whole picture. There's plenty else to work on about all the things that are hard and challenging about our losses as well. But it's kind of a nice to find an open channel. Okay, so one other piece about what blocks us, that is as you determine what your blocks are, which might be the same as other people's are different, that it helps you, once you determine what they are, to be able to find compassion for yourself. Of course those blocks are there. They're completely understandable. And in approaching them that way, instead of the blocks are something bad or wrong, the blocks are something that I need to find a way to obliterate, to be able to say, oh, it's trying to protect me somehow from a fear of being consumed or being embarrassed if I cry or, you know, that scrambling feeling of getting away from reassurance and fixing that I don't enjoy at all. Whatever those pieces are. And the one that's about the getting through the day, that sometimes that block of, I've got other things to do. I need to pay my bills or I need to address things in life. And I don't want to get lost in this. And the do want is, oh, yes, I want to find ways to meet the rest of my life and not cordon this off into a locked vault. I want to move to the next piece, and I encourage you, if you're listening, wherever you are, that if you've been sitting for a while, that you wiggle around a little bit and take a breath and notice that you're sitting in your own lovely human body, whatever it has for you, it's yours. And to consider this next question. What happens when you don't grieve? What happens when there's some feeling that you have, any feeling at all, about having lost something, and you don't let it happen? You tell it no and make it go sit in the corner. What happens in you? How do you tend to behave, to react? What shows up in your life when you've got grief to grieve and you don't let it, when you avoid it or tell it no? I wondered if I could hear from a few people as you explore this. What happens when you don't?
I get numb and scared. And the more scared I get, the more I numb.
Yeah, so a cycle of numb, scared, more numb, more removed from life.
Yeah.
And when that happens, are there predictable patterns of what comes out of that?
Yeah. I lose my authenticity and I start being superficial because I don't want to let anybody in.
So on top of whatever else the loss was, when that numb, scared cycle comes up, you end up with this loss of authenticity and superficiality that has you even farther from getting to have you engaged in life and relations with others.
Yeah.
I so relate to that one. I really feel the weight of that cycle.
Yeah.
Anyone else want to share what happens when you don't?
Different things happen in different circumstances relating to different kinds of grief. So when I have grief in my relationship with my husband and I'm not acknowledging it or speaking to it or feeling it, then it turns into anger. I get very irritable and angry. The long-term health issues that I have when I'm not being able to actively grieve those issues and the way that they've impacted my life and the losses that I've had as a result, that turns to depression. And then there are a kind of grief that I have that relates to really hard and painful things that happen in the world, traumatic things that happen in the world that create a lot of fears for me. And I'm realizing that the fear is really about not being able to grieve that these things really happen. These tragedies happen, that these traumas happen. I certainly don't want them to happen to my child. But it's really about grief. It's grieving that they really do happen. And when I'm not grieving that or accepting that, it turns into fear, very intense fear. And then the last thing that happens is incredible fatigue. It's incredible fatigue.
Would sound similar to, you know, that kind of numb, tired, exhausted. What do I do with this?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm also glad that you named that cycle of the first one, the anger and irritability, right? That one of the things that can happen is that, well, I can't grieve, and so I got to find something to pinpoint my finger at. And you're kind of close. You're right here in my house. You're off target. So that kind of, you know, what we say in BC is like, you know, jack o' lanterns out, you know, like there must be something wrong with you or bad or I don't know what you did, but it shouldn't be this way. It just shouldn't be this way. And so that anger, irritability pattern, you know, I think, wow, if we have more access to our heartfelt grief, not like making it up, but our heartfelt grief, I would probably have a lot less anger and irritability with the people in my life if I noticed that there was grief raising its hand for me to pay attention to. Third one, that piece about fears, especially about state of the world, you know, that's where Joanna Macy's frame really has supported me wholly in that of, I think the suffering thought is, I can't stand this. I can't stand to notice this. It's too painful. It's too awful. So I have fear about feeling, about noticing. And so in that place, those fears can really whip into a frenzy and feel paralytic. I wonder if you have anything hearing those reflections or if anything else comes
up. Oh, yeah. About the anger and irritability, I shared in our breakout that one of my blocks is discomfort or the way that I have been trained and internalized the message of not being vulnerable, you know, that I have a real fear of being vulnerable and I have a real difficulty crying. So when something comes up in my marriage and I feel a lot of pain and I'm even aware that it's pain and grief or a yearning or an unmet need, because I have that real conditioning to not be vulnerable or to cry, my switch flips to anger. And I've been really trying to highlight that block that you had us work on earlier, which for me is about being vulnerable, is really connected to grief turning into anger.
Yeah, that's beautiful, because it is a vulnerable thing, especially given what we talked about in terms of the blocks, right? If we're having fears, for instance, the fear of being consumed by it, then that seems pretty scary. And so it's like, okay, I'm not going to go there, and then that vulnerability doesn't have a chance to be held or seen by ourselves or by anyone else. So then our protections come up, and we go to anger and irritability and, you know, maybe blame and resentment and all kinds of other less pleasant patterns. It's really beautiful that you've got it linked to, wow, what is my inquiry around? What would allow me to be vulnerable? What would support my vulnerability in having a sense that it's safe to show?
Thank you.
So I'm glad the anger came up, because where I push people away is in the reactions and the anger. So I'm not going to let you in because I'm going to overreact to a situation and create a space that's not safe for somebody else and push them away, and that way they're not going to get close to me. So I'm glad somebody else brought that up. The other thing that came to mind for me was I stay in my head, move away from my heart, and I get caught up in very heady, emotionless activities. I'm a recovering addict, and so there is the real danger of me getting back into drugs or alcohol because I want to numb the feelings. And then lastly, a pattern that a friend helped me realize recently that I'm working on catching myself in the short term is I focus on saving other people. You know, if I can help other people, then I don't have to deal with my situation. In the end, very often in the last year or so, they've ended up dragging me down and almost being like a noose around my neck, because not only am I not in a position to help them, I haven't taken care of my own needs. And so now I've got both of our weights around my shoulder, and it's like a sinking ship. So I have to watch not only the anger, but the tendency to save other people. And that's a lot more acceptable to, you know, people around me of, oh, isn't Todd generous? Isn't he helpful? Isn't he looking after people and helping? But it's actually just as dangerous as the anger or the irritability or the addiction.
Thank you for naming all those pieces about the saving others, because certainly there are times, right? It has to do with what's going on in us that motivates what could be an act of service, right? Which can sometimes get your attention out of suffering. You know, there are times that it can really save you to save somebody else or to have that service. But if it's for the quote-unquote wrong reasons, right, it's like it's a distraction, or it's, I'm going to go for this because then I can get some strokes from other people for doing this thing, and then I'm depleted. But, you know, I can't do anything for them or me, right? That's a pretty spirally spiral. It thinks fast. So I'm so glad you named that. And then that going for addiction, that kind of numbing addiction, get me out of here. I don't want to feel this. It's amazing to me how many possible things we can treat as an addiction in humankind. There's all the standards of drugs or alcohol or sugar or shopping and reading, and there's so many different things that we can approach that way as a get me out of here. Don't make me be with myself. Don't make me be with this life that's in me. Let me go to a different place. So it's helpful self-knowledge for all of us to know, yeah, what are the things that I reach for in that way? And when do I reach for them? Is there any support around that I could sit, even if it's you know, my own journal or something like that, and to say, well, is there anything that I love specifically that I've lost lately that I want to make room for, just to see what's there? Sometimes when I reach into the cabinet for the chocolate, as my hand's going up, I say, what's going on, Kristen? Can we have an honest chat with ourselves? Is this a desire for chocolate, or is this something hard that I'm trying to stay away from? And lastly, I think the one you said of staying in your head, intellectually trying to figure it all out, and, you know, there are many different forms of that, so that kind of intellectual approach to life that, again, can be of real service, but when it's there as a don't do this instead kind of substitution, it often isn't as life-serving. I would love to, once again, have you have an opportunity to think for a moment about, because you've heard some of these from other people, what happens when you don't grieve what you have to grieve? And you have a chance to look at that and think, oh yeah, so where do these show up for me? What are the patterns that I see in my life again and again? And some of them probably bother you more than others. Some of them have more of a cost to yourself, your own heart, your life, or in your relationship. Giving you a chance to just note for yourself. You might want to write something down. You might just let it come to the forefront of your awareness. What happens when you don't? And then I want to move to the next, in my mind, the next logical question, which is, what supports your access to being with yourself with whatever loss occurs? That might take a lot of different forms. And I want to think about which needs support you which needs are involved in supporting your access to being with yourself, and which strategies. Knowing that the answer might differ depending on the magnitude of the loss inside in your own inner world, I want to give you yet another chance to be in a dyad, to consider what supports your access to being with yourself with this loss. Are there strategies or needs that help? Wonderful. I'm hoping that some of that was fruitful and that we get to share some of that fruit now in terms of sharing what you've discovered about what supports your access to being with yourself, of that kind of self-connection, even in a time of loss or even when you're noticing loss. I want to invite people to share some needs or strategies that really support them.
For me, what really supports access to myself is to be with somebody else, whenever that may be, whether it's on the phone or actually in person, to have somebody else there to listen to me, to hear what's going on for me, seems to set me up in a place where it feels like permission, it feels like there's space. For me, it's very, very helpful to have that, and I find I have much better access to my own self-connection when I'm with somebody else that I can share and perhaps get a reflection of what I've shared and have some mutuality. So that's been very helpful to me. And sometimes I find that that's available and sometimes it's not available. Sometimes I do find the challenge that I forget that option is available, because that certainly wasn't what I learned growing up in my family or in my earlier adult experience. That's a more recent habit, a more recent skill that I've been able to work with.
Thank you. And I happen to know that you've got some kind of high-quality people to share with, that tends to be, it's not just someone else, but it's someone else, I'm guessing, that you trust can hear you, receive you, hold you, not go into reassurance, advice, fixing, finding you wrong, telling you what you ought to do instead, all of that kind of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, for me, having somebody who can hear perhaps as close as possible without judgment and just to hear what's alive in me. And yeah, you're right. I have some high quality folks in my life that I get to do that with.
I know that at least those of you I know on the phone also have that true, right? Have at least some access to people for whom you have, you know, a degree of trust that they can be with you during this. And then, of course, we all have people in our lives that we don't have that same degree of trust with. You kind of know that kind of sense of somebody who's going to reassure or fix, and, you know, how you scramble to get away from those opportunities just when you're really needing that kind of caring support and presence, not trying to change you present. But that's such an incredibly valuable thing to have in order to hold space for your grief. I wonder if anyone else would like to share what supports your access to being with yourself?
For me, it's trusting in myself that my mourning process does not need to be logical, reasonable, or intellectual,
mm-hmm.
and coming at it too with an understanding that what my current day loss is really just a stimulus for a much deeper loss that goes back to childhood, and grieving at such a profound level, allowing myself to, you know, do the primal screaming and crying, and that not sticking with when, you know, I start crying or being upset about grieving the current loss, to just allow it the freedom to flow as it does back to crying about not having a relationship with a mother or father growing up, you know, and just allowing for that and not having judgment about it, that it has to follow a certain logical form.
Right. So I really hear the space that gives you both the framework and the perspective of, there's a bigger loss that happened a long time ago, and this is linked up. It's linked up to that. Now, I don't have to understand how or why. I don't have to make up a story about it or do an analysis or any of that. I just get to let this come out the way it comes out, which might not look however my mind thinks it ought to look. It might take different forms than what I see as predictable or socially acceptable even, or any of those things.
Yeah, and it's definitely letting go of the socially acceptable piece because, you know, I think for me it's just so cleansing and so freeing to be able to just to finally scream no and have voice and just scream out about the injustice, like, that's not fair, no, and I'd not have been like that, and just, you know, whatever, letting mm-hmm. it go, just letting it rip, letting it come out.
Letting it rip, yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that, because I think we have, at least, as I look at myself and other people I've worked with, invisible restraints all over the place, you know, invisible jackals. Don't be too messy. Don't be too loud. Don't be too irrational. All that kind of stuff is kind of almost creates a maze through which you have to go in order to just let it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad you moved that. The letter rip. You have something that you wanted to share as well?
Yeah, I have a bad hair day, Liv. I had a really bad day, and then a few days later I was with a bunch of friends and I was saying that I'd had a bad day, and several of them said, well, why didn't you call me? And my reply was, it didn't occur to me. I know that when I'm disconnected from myself, that if I have some reminders that I can go to and say, oh, yes, that would work, I could do that.
So that, I always think of the piece that in my mind is attributed to the Kashtan sisters, you know, that the moment of choice, to be able to do something, you drawing on some of the tools and skills and practices of nonviolent communication, first you have to remember that it's possible. So there has to be something in our minds that say, oh, remember, there's something I could do. I could try one of these. And then the second thing is, do I have the skill? Have I done it, you know, once or twice or 500 times so that I actually know how? And then third, am I willing? Am I willing? And this goes back to sometimes I might not be willing to, even if I remember and I have the skill, I might not be willing to dial and ask for somebody to listen for any number of reasons. And those are really good ones to get support about. But that, you know, do I remember? Can I remember that something is possible? Something different than this behavior form pattern that seems so many times I've heard it inside of myself. And I'm going to say a few other things about things that I keep in my back pocket about what supports access to being with self during loss. One of them is being able to notice what I'm thinking about something and how those thoughts might be contributing to staying in suffering rather than staying in mourning, than going to mourning or grieving. I think of suffering thoughts around mourning as, there are a lot of different categories, but I'm going to name a few and we'll see if that stirs any of you. I can't stand this. I should be over this by now. Other people don't feel this way for this long. It's just because I'm messed up that I care. Other people have it way worse than I do, and so I should get over this. I think those are my favorites. Favorites in quotes, I should say. But being able to tell when I'm in that kind of suffering thinking, being able to call it out. And, you know, this is in some ways, I think, at the very heart of NBC is the ability to tell what I'm thinking and to be able to differentiate from it and say, is this entirely true? Can I get a little bit of me to observe that this is my thought about what's happening? It's not directly what's happening. It's not the observation. It's my thought. And it generally results in my reaching for addiction or other behaviors that are life alienating in some way. And I want to come back to at those times, oh, that's the thought about the grief. That's the thought about the feelings I'm having. What are the actual felt sensations I'm having? What is actually happening in my body and my emotional plane? What is it that I'd like to come back to about kind of the purity of how I am with the loss? Is there some condition that I can set up, some listener or even witnessing myself in some way? Do I want to do an interpretive dance about this or a piece of art? Or is there some way that I can express what's in me without it needing to be logical, reasonable, or intellectual? That to be able to invite, I have something to say, some part of me has something to say about its experience of loss that is distracted by those suffering thoughts of I ought to be over this by now, or what's wrong with me, or something like that. That's one of those pieces that feels like it's really helpful in terms of supporting access to being with self, is growing that skill of noticing your thoughts, noticing what suffering thoughts are there, and being able to grow the capacity to differentiate from them, to get a little bit observer about them. So I'm wondering if you resonate with that, if that makes sense to you in some way, and let me just see how that lands. And then I would love to invite either whether it resonated with you or doesn't seem to fit, if there are comments or questions about that piece. It may even be that someone's got common suffering thoughts that you'd like to voice. It's a gift to other people because it's easier to hear them, I believe, if you're kind of on the lookout for them.
I guess where I get a little confused in that differentiation piece is like the I should get over this, maybe, you know, that's a common thing, or other people are worse, all of those sort of helpful things. It feels like they have some validity on some place too. It almost sounds like hopping over that to get to what's real, but it feels to me like those are places in me that also have a valid something to say. And so I do get being back into the body and really feeling what's happening in the body is kind of maybe the core of the grieving, but also those places that are trying to keep us away from being back in the body by, no, don't go there because other people have it worse, so don't go there. You know, they all seem kind of excuses for not feeling into the body, but they also seem to have some richness on their own. I don't know what the question is, but it's just a kind of confusion because it almost sounds like you're dismissing the suffering thoughts as being something to notice and then jump over.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked because, you know, everything that comes through us has got some, I really do believe, it's got some beauty attached to it. It's got some longing attached to it. And so that, like, other people have it worse. Yeah, so I do want to notice the gifts that I have in relation to other people. And I do want to have sensitivity to other people's suffering. I do want to notice the fullness of my experience, not just this and not kind of get lost in the drama, you know, like this is the only thing that's true.
Yeah.
I'm prone to that, too. Mentally, that can happen in me. So I do want to have that validity recognized, and I also want to notice when I'm stopping myself with those kind of thoughts and give them a chance to kind of step out of the way of blocking what else is there for me for at least a brief time to be able to, you know, for instance, I should be over this by now. Many times I've led grief workshops, people talk about how that message comes through to them. It has come through to them so many times. They've been told that, read that, you know, you should be, this is time for you to be done. 2 weeks is long enough to grieve this, or a year, or something like
that.
And so we've heard it so many times, we've internalized that thought. And it stops us. It can just be like a big burly cop with a stop sign standing in the road. I guess I'm supposed to be over it by now, so I should just do something else. And it's still really there. So each one of those thoughts has something that it's longing for. And we want to hear all of it. You know, we want to hear the beauty, the longing behind every bit. And some of them are well-trained to stop us in our tracks.
Yeah. Okay. That to me is a bit of the dance internally, is to honor them, listen to them for what's there, but not believe them in a way that it distracts us or keeps us away from feeling into the tender place or the more body-centered grieving place.
Yeah, I love that kind of dance, you know, to be able to have a willingness to look and listen and to have some discernment about where the life is, which thing is calling out. The same words in my head can at one time call me toward life and another time block me from it.
Yeah.
It's even trickier. So it's that willingness to listen in. And for many people, I think it's slow down enough to make a space to find out, what's calling here? What wants to be known? What wants to be heard?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I haven't been stopped by any of the thoughts that you mentioned, but I noticed one thought that causes a contraction with me is, and when I say it, I notice a sort of a caving in to sort of this black funnel, is the thought that my son is dead. And in classic NVC, I think most people would call that an observation. And I've been, even in just the exercise, which was just an absolutely delicious exercise of just bringing back those little things, that little, like, the way he'd, like, look into my eyes with these big brown eyes and then look down and smile. Is that vulnerability, that tenderness of his gentleness is just so alive in me. It just that thought just doesn't ring as true. You know, it's like I'm not quite believing that thought, but I notice that I can, it's very easy for me to, the words that want to come out is like sink into the drama, and I don't think that does really that black whirlpool justice, the realness of that. It does dismiss it, like, but I mean, to be in, I really like to stay in that kind of inquiry, is like, is it true? And to explore that, just to not try to talk myself out of, like, really being with the depths of that despair when it's there, but to be willing also to question whether it's true or not. I long to continue to be with that inquiry.
I love your description of it, and the soft, I almost feel it as like soft fingers palpating, you know, like that exploration to be able to say, wow, so what happens in me when I think of that as true, and what happens in me when I think of that as not true, and, you know,
exactly,
with permission to have any answer at all.
Oh, absolutely. Just to stay with the questions of even questioning the observation. Like, everybody would agree with you. It's like, well, yeah, you must be in denial. I don't know. No one's ever said that. No one's, hasn't been long enough for that one yet. But, yeah, just that soft, I like that description a lot, just tenderly exploring these different experiences of life, of my life energy in this moment.
Thank you. I feel so into the freshness and the willingness, the courage and the willingness to explore that, you know, to be with what is this scene now. I do want to share that someone said something to me that I found exceptionally comforting, around grief, and that is that we have so many brain cells, so many neurons that are tied up, that are connected. You know, you have so many connected to your son that not all of them have gotten the message yet. And that felt very different to me than denial. Denial, which kind of said, well, I know it and I'm trying not to know it. Versus there's neurons that just haven't heard. They don't know. And there's so many of them that of course they don't believe that. And that gave me immense comfort because I was so shocked by how many times I thought, why do I not believe this is true? I was here when she died. What? How could I not know this? It helped me go back to a place of inquiry with it instead of some kind of going off on a tangent thinking I was in denial and there was something wrong with me about being in denial. So I hope that that has a chance to serve either you or someone else who's listening. Thank you. So I know that we're at the end of our first session, but I want to first say a few things of encouragement as you step into life outside of this telecall. One is that to the extent that you can, because you've turned to face, to notice your loss, and to notice something about what blocks it, what happens when you don't feel it, what supports it, all those pieces, that I encourage you to do anything you can to be gentle with yourself in the coming hours or even the coming days. It may be that something has kind of risen up that you haven't noticed lately or that was held back. So if you know things that can be gentle with yourself, or if you have a choice, do I do this really hard thing right now while I feel crappy, or do I do something that is the equivalent of putting my own tender human hand on my face? Choose the latter if you can. So I want to encourage that. And I want to say for the coming week, if you want to explore some more, you might think about what is it that you would like to say to that which you lost, or what is it that you would like to hear? And we'll play around with this, with that concept next time. But I want to let that germinate a little bit in you, because it might be that some of that work happens between now and then. I want to encourage you to take 2 or 3 slower, softer breaths to acknowledge yourself for stepping towards something that sometimes people stay away from, to appreciate your own human heart, wherever it is right now, to let one breath out with a sigh or a sound, howl or a moan or whatever is there. We'll recommence next week, same time.